Well, good morning. This is Per Fograng with Chapter 56 of Fight the Empire. First, I got a little announcement here. This is a local seminar. The Pacific Center for Global Justice is having a couple of fall seminars. And each seminar is about 4 to 5 times meetings, and there is a modest cost. But the first seminar will focus on militarism, and the second course is called Four Engagements. And you can find out more about that by calling the they're offered at the at a school. Where is that school now? It's Cedarwood Waldorf School at 3030 Southwest 2nd Avenue. Now, you can go to the website. It's www.PCGJ, that's Pacific Center for Global Justice, PCGJ.org, or you can call. There's a phone number to call here, I believe. Let's see. Call 617-999-3689. Okay, I think I'd go to the website. So now on to our topic for today. Our guest is Stephen Klein, who is a writer who has written for New Republic, Atlantic Monthly, The Nation, and even The Wall Street Journal. He's got a book that is just out called State versus Defense, The Battle to Define America's Empire. And you can follow him on Twitter at SGLAIN. So Stephen Klein, welcome to KABU.
Thank you, Bert. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, this is very interesting art. Let's say a little bit about your book. Tell us about your book, and then we'll get into the article you wrote about the Pentagon's China plan.
Sure. Well, I wrote the book to focus on what I perceived some years back as the growing militarization of U.S. foreign policy. Which is something I encountered working overseas as a foreign correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, as you mentioned. But I wanted to get into the history of it to see what was the genesis of this process. And so the book of World War II, and I try to show the inflection points throughout that sweep of history where American presidents embraced a military option to what was really a diplomatic challenge, and why? Why do they default constantly to that option?
Well, apparently, according to your article, the Pentagon is sort of giving up, it's hard to believe, but redeploying troops from the Persian Gulf to China. So the way you phrase it, they're sort of trading in two quagmires for one new one.
Well, we have flag officers, commanding officers, talking about their desire to redeploy troops that are now in the Middle East to Asia, where they think they're under-resourced. There certainly is a considerable arms buildup going on of U.S. Materiel and weaponry, and there's some building up of new installations to accommodate new personnel. So that process is in train, and the Chinese, not surprisingly, are responding in kind with countermeasures of their own. So that's where it stands right now.
So now in your article, you say they are adapting this concept of air-sea battle and changing it to deal with China. So tell us, what is the air-sea battle concept?
Well, as I understand it, it's an operating principle for combat. It was, I believe, it was codified in the 1990s.
Oop, are you there?
I'm sorry.
You cut out for a minute there.
Oh, it was codified during the 1990s, or developed in the 1990s, and most recently codified in a 2009 Navy Air Force memorandum. And it's a vehicle for the U.S. to address asymmetrical threats around the world, according to a very interesting story inside the Pentagon. It's being adapted to for the sake of confronting China.
Well, you could say in a way that since the Soviet Union is no longer around, any war the U.S. gets into is sort of asymmetrical.
Well, that's true, and it has to be said that the U.S. doesn't have a very good track record waging those kinds of wars, nor does anyone, really. I'm sure some people say, well, the Brits did a good job in Malaysia, and the French did a compelling job in Algeria for a time, but ultimately they were evicted. So asymmetric warfare is a very difficult thing to pull off, especially when you're looking at the world's most populous country. So we're entering precarious waters, both literally given the disputed sea lanes in Asia that's causing so much antagonism, as well as figuratively.
So how would this concept address asymmetrical warfare? What would it do?
Well, we can look at what the Pentagon's doing now, and it is developing a network of bases and installations that is effectively surrounding China. So this just last week it was reported it's kind of percolating to the surface here in the West that the U.S. Navy, along with the South Korean government, is developing a naval installation, naval missile installation on Jeju Island in the south of the southern tip of the Korean Peninsula, for example. Throughout the last decade, the U.S. has been developing alliances and bases in the Central Asia and the Caucasus, which is right on China's doorstep. And the U.S. has been very assiduous in establishing and enhancing its military-to-military relations with Southeast Asia. So from the standpoint of China, there is a noose, and it's tightening.
Mm-hmm. Well, then you mentioned this chain of bases and also this nuclear energy deal with India, which is sort of meant to thwart China. How is China responding? I mean, China's apparently they are buying oil all over the place. They are making business deals with Afghanistan. We're fighting a war, and China's coming in and buying up mineral resources and things like that.
That's true. The Chinese, over the last couple decades, they've been very intelligent and resourceful in the way they've developed relationships with resource-rich nations. It should come as no surprise that they show no compunction in terms of cozying up with pretty odious regimes, as do we. But they've done a very smart job of focusing on economic development and winning the goodwill of third world peoples or peoples in developing countries, whereas, of course, we've been busy building bases and waging wars in the Middle East, which has not engendered much goodwill on our behalf. But I should also add that over the last 2 years, the Chinese they kind of broke form, and they've been acting very aggressively in a almost gratuitous manner with regards to their neighbors, and they've been flouting diplomatic and global norms in a way that I think is retarding that goodwill, and it will redound to their disfavor to the extent that several years ago China's neighbors were telling the Americans, don't make us choose between you and China. In other words, don't ask us to host a naval base or an airstrip to contain China, because China is very important to us, and we believe it's evolving in a manageable and responsible way. Now they're telling the Americans, don't leave, or yes, we'd be happy to accommodate whatever you might need to keep China to heel. So in that sense, China is hurting itself.
Mm-hmm.
It is being very aggressive in interpreting some of these the limits of its sovereignty in the South China Sea and in East Asia. So it's not as if China is not posing a serious challenge. My concern is there doesn't seem to be much of an impetus on either side to deal with these challenges diplomatically.
Well, now you mentioned that there are these islands in the South China Sea. I think the Spratly Islands is one bunch of them, and a lot of that has to do with oil resources underneath those islands. But you say there are six nations that have claims on these islands, and the U.S. is not trying to sort of resolve it. Basically, the U.S. is siding against China.
Effectively. Now, Secretary of State Clinton ago or months ago called for a multilateral round to address some of these issues. Given China's sensibilities, that is not a constructive way to go about it. I'm sure she knew that the Chinese would emphatically reject such a proposal. But in a very canny way, she put it on the table to put the Chinese on the defensive. I think history shows that when you're dealing with something of this magnitude, these claims, by the way, go back centuries. They're very complex. It's probably best to do it quietly, at least at first, in a kind of a shuttle diplomacy type equation, and try to establish some goodwill first, and then gestures to follow.
Well, I think some would say that this strategy of encircling China goes back a long way, too. This old heartland obsession that some of our foreign policy people seem to have. And this was first put forth by a gentleman named Halford Mackinder back in 1919. The idea that whoever controls the Eurasian heartland kind of rules the world. And it was said that Kissinger had nightmares of the China and the Soviet Union sort of allying themselves, you know, and so this has been going on for a while.
Well, certainly the illusion of the Sino-Soviet bloc was a very compelling one and a very damaging one, because refusing to relinquish that illusion, the United States ended up grossly inflating the threats arrayed against it, especially in Asia. I go in depth into my book using declassified Soviet documents, which showed that a war on the Korean Peninsula was the last thing that Stalin wanted, and he tried to discourage it until it was obvious that Kim Il-sung, the dictator, the founder and dictator of North Korea, was going regardless. That's a mirage that died hard, even as China and Russia were engaging in border skirmishes. Their members of Congress were still decrying the Sino-Soviet bloc. So that did a lot to complicate and compromise our foreign policy.
Well, one thing that I really find interesting is you mentioned this document from 2001, that the 2025 vision of China being I got the original article on it, China bent on Asian dominance.
Right.
And can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, it came out just prior to 9/11, the September 11 attacks, at a time when, let's face it, if you looked at the horizon, there wasn't much in the way of immediate threats. The Soviet Union was long gone. And I interpret in this document just your classic threat inflation and fear-mongering. Keep in mind, this was 10 years ago. China was a robust economy, but it wasn't nearly. The counterclaims in the South China Sea were there, but they did not resonate the way they do today. China's defense spending as a ratio of GDP was much lower than it is now. It was simply not the threat that this document made it out to be. But again, when I was researching the book, State versus Defense, I came across this all the time, this habitual or reflexive need to overstate the threats confronting a country that is geographically almost impregnable. And I'm talking about, obviously, the U.S., which has two peaceful borders to its north and south and two enormous oceans to its east and west.
Well, and also, this 2025 document, well, one of the things they have is a Taiwan scenario where China blockades Taiwan, then the U.S. sends warships, then China responds with either missile strikes on those ships or the threat, mm-hmm. and this kind of makes the ball is in America's court.
Right, right.
And if the U.S. backs down, then other Asian nations decide, well, the U.S. isn't going to help us, so we better make nice with China.
Right, right. And I've been hearing this for years. I mean, I moved to Asia just as a for this the sake of adventure back in 1986, and I was hearing that scenario even then. Since then, China's had ample opportunity to invade Taiwan, with the U.S. Focusing on the Middle East or Vietnam or whatever, and it is very carefully avoided even provoking to invade Taiwan or preparing to invade Taiwan. You could say the same thing about North Korea, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's had numerous opportunities to take advantage of America's fatigue from its numerous wars, and it didn't do it. These are not suicidal regimes. Now, having said that, I can appreciate the military's imperative to plan not against intentions but capabilities, and China now has the capability to cross the Formosa Strait and invade and occupy Taiwan. So it's fair enough for the Pentagon to war game against that. But to talk about China as an aspiring global hegemon, when 3,000 years of Chinese history suggest just the opposite, is irresponsible.
Well, it's like what the psychologists call transference.
Exactly.
You ascribe your own motives to your adversary. What interesting thing is you bring in that this air-sea battle concept, and also you mention another document, which is the 1992 Defense Planning Guidance.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which, in a way, I think I got a copy of that somewhere here. But anyway, basic point there is that the U.S. Is going to be number one. It will allow no other nation to come close to challenging us. Now, that's really kind of staking out a lot of territory, isn't it?
Exactly. And anyone who would be hostile to the United States or critical of the United States for its imperial impulse needs to go no further than the 1992 Defense Planning Guidance, which I focus on in my book. It is as blatant a manifesto for the sake of global hegemony and imperium as you're likely to find anywhere. And it does commit the United States to preempt the emergence of a so-called peer competitor anywhere in the world. So that means not just a global competitor, such as the Soviet Union, to the extent that it was a viable threat or global threat, as well as a regional competitor, which China aspires to be. And so if you are faithful to the precepts of the 1992 Defense Planning Guidance, then some kind of conflict with China between China and the United States is inevitable.
Mm-hmm. What... One thing I've been wondering, you know, there's been a lot of this kind of hostility with China. What if China responds by dumping the dollar? I mean, our pundits say that, well, China will never do that because it would hurt their own export economy.
Right.
But you
right.
see, at some point, if we threaten their interests enough, I think China would dump the dollar. How likely do you think that is?
Well, that's a very good point, and it's particularly resonant now. I know that I gather Vice President Biden got an earful of complaints from his hosts when he went to Beijing about the sustainability of the U.S. economy.
Oh, do you know any more about that? Because I just heard he's there and sort of meeting the guy who's going to be the next president of China.
Right. I only know what's in the papers, but it's well known. The Chinese have made very clear their concern over the security of their massive investment. Together with Japan, they hold They are America's largest creditor, and between China and Japan, they hold two-thirds of our sovereign debt. Now, it's important to point out that this is not a good bet for them. The dollar is a diminishing asset and has been diminishing since the 80s. And there are a lot of ordinary Chinese who are wondering why their patrimony has been invested in such a commodity. And you're also right in that we seem to take for granted that because we're locked in this mutual embrace or this yin and yang embrace with the Chinese, our debt for their products, that's going to inure us from any kind of or render us immune from any kind of conflict. But China was not our largest creditor 10 years ago, and I'll bet most economies would doubt it's going to be our largest creditor 10 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
It's perfectly logical and understandable for them to want to slowly, and hopefully in a transparent way, unwind some of those dollar positions. Wall Street is doing it. I know investment managers who were dumping their dollar positions in favor of a basket of currencies in order to hedge their positions. So why wouldn't sovereign wealth funds, including China's?
Well, I think China has a big, huge internal market that they might want to satisfy sometime.
Yeah.
And if they ever do, if they ever do kind of get closer to Russia and other Central Asian nations, there's this huge kind of heartland market that at that point China may decide that hey, they don't need the U.S. export market at all.
It's true. I mean, they're going to be doing more and more business. I think Asia is already their largest exporter.
Mm-hmm.
It will soon be their largest export market, and it's only natural. It's their region. It's their neighbors. And that's where the wealth is going to be in the next 100 years. On the other hand, their relationship with the United States is a very mature one. There's not nearly as much growth potential there.
Mm-hmm.
So China's going to be doing business in Korean won, in Vietnam dong, and rubles, in ringgit, in rupees, you name it. And I think that over time, and again, it has to be a gradual process, is going to erode the global appetite for the dollar generally.
Well, one thing that I've been talking about a lot in previous shows is the idea of peak oil, and the price of oil is sort of bound to go up.
Yeah.
We've used up the cheap oil. We're getting to the expensive oil, and at some point you might get to a situation where it costs more energy to get the oil than we get in return. And so what does expensive oil do to this kind of our global ambitions?
Well, that's a good question. I know this, that a cheaper dollar is going to make it more difficult for us to finance a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Washington, they're talking about cutting defense spending, which is fine. One thing I don't hear is a national discussion about our overseas bases and the cost of maintaining and operating those bases, some of which are legacies of the Cold War. We're spending an enormous amount of money protecting countries which are rich, which have a very high standard of living and have more than enough financial resources at their disposal to mine their own national security obligations. So I think if we refrain from asking our allies to assume the lion's share of their security burden, we are only putting ourselves deeper in the hole.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking with Stephen Glain about his article. It's in Salon Online Magazine, The Pentagon's New China War Plan. He's also the author of a book just out, State versus Defense. So thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Let me just ask one more. How likely do you think this is to happen, or is it kind of...
You mean some kind of conflict between the U.S. and China?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sort of quick answer here.
Well, the U.S. is not going to yield on its global hegemony ambitions, and China is not going to yield on what it thinks is its historical prerogative in the region. So, again, absent a diplomatic solution or a way to reconcile those two positions, I think some kind of conflict is inevitable.
Oh, boy. Okay, unless peak oil just sort of knocks everything for a loop. Anyway, thank you very much. I've been talking with Stephen Glane, author of The Pentagon's New China War Plan, and you can read that on the Salon Magazine website. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me on.
And let me give that announcement one more time about the Pacific the seminars. This is the the Center for Global Justice. Oh, here we go. Okay, it is the Pacific Center for Global Justice. They are having two seminars, one on militarism and one on the four engagements. And you can find out more about that by going to their website, pcgj.org. They are having these seminars starting soon, and they sound very interesting. They are here in Portland. And so stay tuned. This has been Chapter 56 of Fight the Empire, and stay tuned for Flashpoints.